From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Public testimony in the impeachment inquiry against President Trump begins tomorrow morning. You can hear the full day's events plus NPR analysis. Scheduled to testify are Deputy Assistant Secretary of State responsible for Ukraine, George Kent, and the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine, William B. Taylor, Jr. The coverage here in the West will begin at 7 a.m. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today about the Trump administration's cancellation of DACA. In the studio with me, Kevin R. Johnson, Dean and Professor of Law at UC Davis School of Law. Welcome. I used the past tense. I said heard because arguments, I understand, are already wrapped up.
The arguments ended just a few minutes ago.
So let's back up, and I want to say up front that the UC system, which UC Davis is part of, is a plaintiff in some of the action against the administration. You also filed an amicus brief in one of the cases. So are we able to have this conversation from your perspective as a law professor? And when you're speaking in relation to the UC case, would you clarify that as well?
Sure. My views are my views, not the University of California's views. And I did lay out some of these views in an amicus brief in the U.S. Supreme Court, along with a number of other immigration law professors. But what I'll be talking about today are my views.
So let's talk about what you're seeing and hearing about how arguments went this morning.
Well, I understand that there's a fair amount of question about the court's ability to review the decision of the Trump administration to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That's pretty normal in immigration cases when the question is there judicial review of the executive's decision? So I think that'll probably be part of the opinion. I also get the sense from preliminary reports is that there was a fairly closely divided court. And some people said before the argument, and some people said after the argument, that the pivotal player here will be the Chief Justice John Roberts.
A decision might not come until the end of session, end of June, correct?
It's likely that we won't have a decision until the end of June. It's probably going to be a divided court. The last time the Supreme Court addressed a deferred action issue, it split 4-4. It was before the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch. So in this instance, my guess would be last week of June, if not the last day of the term.
So DACA, in this particular version of the policy, goes back to 2012 under the Obama administration. And DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Policy. Do we have a ruling on that policy itself as to whether it's lawful or not?
Well, there is no ruling, and there has been no ruling, finding that DACA was unlawful. DACA was challenged not long after it was promulgated in a number of cases, and no court found that DACA was unlawful. There is a claim by some that DACA isn't faithful to the law and that it's unconstitutional and that the executive branch was taking away authority of Congress. But no court has held such, and it is not unprecedented, in fact, DACA. In fact, many administrations from as far back as President Eisenhower's administration have allowed for deferred action for certain categories of non-citizens in the country in violation of the law. President Eisenhower used it for Hungarians who were fleeing Soviet invasion of Hungary. President Reagan used DACA for children of people eligible for legalization, family members of people eligible for legalization under the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. Other presidents, including both Presidents Bush and President Clinton, allowed for deferred action, which is basically a form of prosecutorial discretion in which the executive says, we're not going to focus our removal efforts on this category of people. Rather, we're going to focus our removal efforts on other categories of undocumented people, such as people convicted of crimes and things like that.
The lawsuits before the high court today had to do with whether it was legal for the Trump administration in 2017 to cancel the program, to end the program. Might the court rule overall on the question I just asked on that issue of whether DACA itself is lawful?
Well, basically, the claim of the Trump administration in canceling DACA was that the policy was unlawful and unconstitutional. And that's all the Trump administration said. It didn't say that it wanted to exercise its prosecutorial discretion in some other way. Rather, it said that President Obama had acted unlawfully. So it is possible in looking at the rescission that the Supreme Court will also look at the lawfulness of DACA. It's not necessarily the case because the court could say, for example, well, assuming DACA is legal, still the Trump administration didn't offer a reasoned rationale for eliminating DACA. It didn't offer any kind of detailed statement like the Obama administration did when it issued DACA, showing that it was legal. So the real issue here is one that only law professors could love. It's whether under the Administrative Procedure Act, the Trump administration's rescission of DACA was, quote, arbitrary and capricious. And usually to show that something's not arbitrary and capricious, you have to have some reasoned rationale for the policy. And here, basically, you have very short explanations in written form from Attorney General Sessions and the interim Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Elaine Duke, that DACA was unlawful without any citation to cases, without any explanation, without any clear reasoning behind the conclusion it was unlawful. It sounded and read more like a campaign slogan as opposed to a legal document.
And what that original memo said could end up being the crux of this entire case, correct?
I think it's likely that the court, if it finds that there's room for judicial review here, that the court will look carefully at the explanation, the written memo, and decide whether or not it's sufficient to explain the rescission of a policy that's benefited hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants. And so I think one of the issues really here is even if DACA was not required by the law, once it was put into place, can you remove it without offering any reasoning, without offering a rational explanation, without offering something other than, as one district court said, a bare-bones explanation? So I think here you have a situation where hundreds of thousands of young undocumented people relied on a policy, went to school, took jobs, started lives, built a place in the community, and relied on what their government told them about the policy. Can you take that away? Can you remove that reliance without a reasoned explanation? Or is this explanation reason enough?
I hear you giving us a mix of your views right now, as well as the discussion of the law. And I just made you smile, so I think you're in agreement with what I just said. But can I ask you to put on your law professor hat and tell me what the argument is on the other side, what the argument before the Supreme Court was for cancellation?
Yeah, the basic argument was that this DACA policy was an unlawful policy that didn't comply with the Immigration Nationality Act passed by Congress. It allowed relief and work authorization to a group of non-citizens who, under the immigration laws, are subject to removal from the United States. And so that violation of the law and it also constitutes a violation of the Constitution because the president's supposed to take care to enforce the laws. So the basic claim is that DACA was unlawful, it took away congressional power, and it also violates the Constitution because it means that the president isn't taking care to ensure compliance with the law.
Can you explain how different the DACA policy under the Obama administration was from the kinds of language and policy that had been put in place similarly in previous administrations? Is there a dramatic difference?
No, there's not that much of a difference. I mean, in different situations, the group defined for deferred action has been defined differently depending on the circumstances. The Hungarians were treated different than the family members of amnesty recipients who are different than others defined for deferred action. But basically, deferred action meant in the past that a non-citizen would not be subject to removal and would be eligible for work authorization. This work authorization was authorized by a regulation put into place under the Reagan administration that was designed to ensure that people who were entitled to remain here under the deferred action policy would also be able to work here and be contributing members of the community. Now, I know work authorization is one of the parts of the argument that supporters of rescission have emphasized, but you know, work authorization is something that really traces its way back to a policy and regulation of the Reagan administration.
Dean Kevin R. Johnson is also the Mabee Appalis Professor of Public Interest Law and Professor of Chicano-Chicana Studies at UC Davis School of Law. He joined the faculty in 1989 and has been dean since 2008. In 1993, he was recipient of the law school's Distinguished Teaching Award, and he blogs at Immigration Prof. You are also a regular contributor on immigration on SCOTUS blog. This has been a busy month in writing about Prop 87 and the 25th anniversary, as well as today. So can you talk about California specifically being involved? And the Attorney General, Javier Becerra, is in Washington, D.C. He was not among the team arguing the cases, though, this morning.
No, he wasn't. But he's been an important part of the efforts to challenge some of the Trump administration's immigration policies. He also was involved in the litigation involving the U.S. citizenship question for the census. California has played a very prominent role in resisting some of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement policies. For example, opposing the sanctuary penalties that the Trump administration tried to put into place. And California has the largest number of DACA recipients of any state in the country, has the largest immigrant population of any state in the country, has the largest undocumented immigrant population of any state in the country. And so discussion of immigration in California are often one and the same. So I do think it's entirely understandable and appropriate for the Attorney General to be involved. The University of California also is involved in the litigation as well and brought one of the lawsuits. One of the interesting aspects to the entire DACA litigation is that the person who initially was the mastermind for the DACA policy was Janet Napolitano, who then was the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Currently, Janet Napolitano is the president of the University of California. So she in some ways, is leading an effort by the University of California to save a policy that she helped put into place when she was Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Isn't often the case that you see such an interesting change of place in this kind of litigation. So it is slightly different than what you'd ordinarily see.
There were a number of cases filed immediately after the rescission in 2017, and then a number of parties in other states joined the cases in existence. The three that were heard today, are those the only three the court has accepted or agreed to hear? Will there be more?
No, there's three cases that the Supreme Court consolidated for oral argument and for decision. And the court did that because they really, they basically raised the same question. Was the Trump administration's rescission of DACA lawful or not? And that's the primary issue that the court decided to decide. And these are the major challenges. There's been some other challenges, but these are the major challenges that are likely going to decide the future of DACA.
When you talk about the numbers, I think the number is somewhere between 700,000 and 800,000 DACA recipients nationally. California's number is roughly 200,000. So in this interim of lawsuits, status has stayed the same for DACA recipients. And so it will stay the same until there's a ruling, correct?
That's correct. The DACA recipients, to the extent that they still have DACA and it hasn't expired, they currently are permitted to to seek extension of their DACA status, and some are doing that. Some have decided that the risks are too great to do that, so some DACA recipients aren't seeking to extend it. But for now, the injunctions that the lower courts have put into place require that the DACA recipients be able to renew their status and not to have their status revoked for now.
The High Court has a conservative majority right now. Is it the best guess, or at least reasonable, to expect a 5-4 vote on this case?
I think my best bet would be that there is going to be a 5-4 vote on this case, unless they decided on some very narrow technical ground that dismiss it for a lack of jurisdiction or something like that. But I don't see that happening. I think on the merits, it's going to be a closely divided court. I couldn't tell you precisely how the courts is going to rule. It's always sort of hazardous guesswork to try to guess what the Supreme Court's going to rule. You might remember that after the health care reform cases, everybody thought that the Affordable Care Act was doomed. You might remember that after the U.S. citizenship arguments, many people thought that the citizenship question was going to be on the 2020 census. It's very hard to predict, and I wouldn't hazard a prediction here, but I do think there'll be a closely divided court, and it raises some challenging issues that the court's going to be grappling with until the end of June.
And then the what next for DACA recipients?
Well, it depends on how the court decides DACA, the DACA case. It could decide that the rescission was unlawful.
Are you saying it's a 5-4 vote, but you don't know which way the 5-4 vote will go?
No, I consciously didn't say which way I thought the 5-4 vote would go, because I think that it could be the case that Chief Justice Roberts sides with the four liberal justices on the court and finds that the rationale offered for the Trump administration's rescission of DACA is not acceptable. He did exactly that in the census case, where he said that the Trump administration's explanation for the citizenship question on the 2020 census wasn't convincing, and sent it back for further explanation. I think that in this instance, where you're dealing with a very thin paper record showing why DACA was unlawful, submitted by the Trump administration, that Chief Justice Roberts again could say that, well, we should send this back for further explanation because this just isn't convincing. As I said before, the claim that DACA is unlawful has never been adopted by any court. In some ways, the claim that it's unlawful and unconstitutional does require an explanation. There's court cases, there's doctrine, there's other arguments you can make, but the Trump administration didn't make any of those arguments, didn't lay things out. It contrasts very sharply with what the Obama administration prepared in 2012 to justify DACA as being legal. The Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department prepared a 30-page memorandum outlining why deferred action for childhood arrivals was a lawful program, carefully looked at the cases, carefully looked at the statute, carefully looked at the precedent, and concluded that DACA was lawful. Here, we get a bare-bones explanation from the Trump administration that in some ways reads more like a campaign slogan than a real reasoned analysis. And to the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, I think he might well want to require a bit more in terms of legal analysis.
Dean Johnson, I only have about 30 seconds left, but I do want to talk a bit about tomorrow's impeachment inquiry. The fact that this case is moving into public testimony could carry a different weight. What's your take on that?
You never know, but I do think that having witnesses testify in open session will allow the public to make their own judgments about what they think about whether or not there's an issue here in terms of impeachment. Trial lawyers will always tell you that seeing the live witnesses means something very different than reading the paper transcripts. And it's been a powerful argument to this point that there were secret sessions and secret testimony in Congress about these matters. And I think bringing the light of day to the witnesses, to what they have to say, may or may not, we don't know, change the way the public looks at the entire matter. I tend to think that it might have some difference. I don't know if it'll make a significant difference, but we'll have to see what the witnesses have to say. We'll have to see how the public reacts, and we'll have to see what we hear.
Yes or no? Do you think there's an issue here for impeachment?
I think there's some very, very difficult issues that are raised here that we haven't seen raised by any modern American president that deserve our attention.
Thank you, Dean Johnson. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
Kevin R. Johnson is dean and professor at UC Davis School of Law. We have posted a link to his immigration blog. NPR will have coverage of not only this day at the U.S. Supreme Court, but tomorrow's public testimony. It begins live here on CAP Radio tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.